Greetings to our global neighbors and all the ships at sea. From coast to coast, border to border, this is Message Traffic from Washington, D.C., presented by the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs. Thank you for joining us. I'm Justin Russell, the Principal Director of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs here in Washington, D.C. Recently, we had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Gregory D. Johnson from the Brookings Institution. Dr. Johnson has been a Peace Corps volunteer in Jordan, a Fulbright Fellow in Yemen, and a Fulbright Hayes Fellow in Egypt. He has a doctorate from Princeton University, a master's degree from Princeton and the University of Arizona. Dr. Johnson is also the author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia, published by W.W. Norton, which has been translated into multiple languages. From 2016 to 2018, he served on the Yemen Panel of Experts for the UN Security Council. In 2019, he served as the lead writer for the Syria Study Group, and his writings on Yemen and terrorism has appeared in, among other publications, the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and Foreign Policy. Currently, he is a non-resident fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution. He's also the editor of the Yemen Review and a non-resident fellow for the Sana Center for Strategic Studies. In our discussion, Dr. Johnson will break down the key differences in the Trump and Biden administrations and their approach to foreign policy in the Middle East. We will also look through a comprehensive study of the United States policy towards the conflict in Yemen and what the future might hold for the United States relationship with the main players in the region. Now, our interview with Dr. Gregory Johnson from the Brookings Institution. Dr. Johnson, thank you for joining us here on Message Traffic. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's kind of start off on the bigger picture and then kind of draw down, if we can, into an area that you're very familiar with, that being the situation in Yemen. But let's kind of start off on the bigger picture. I mean, there's been a lot of announcements coming out of the State Department and out of the White House, notably after the announcements by President Biden last week at the State Department. In your eyes, what is the biggest difference or the biggest focus change between what we saw in the Secretary Pompeo State Department versus what we're going to see in a Secretary Blinken State Department?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, obviously the Biden administration is still in its, you know, in its first 100 days. So there's a lot that we still don't know about the Biden administration. But I think we know enough to say that the approach that the Trump administration took, that Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Pompeo had, of sort of America go it alone, our way or the highway, is not going to be the approach that the Biden administration and certainly that Secretary of State Blinken is taking. The Biden administration spent a lot of time and has been very, very public about reaching out to allies across the world, allies in the Middle East, in Europe, in Asia, looking to really break with what it is that the Trump administration was trying to do. And I think, you know, when you look at, say, Middle East policy and the Trump administration's policy to Iran, its maximum pressure campaign, that was not something that a lot of U.S. allies bought into. And that's something that the Biden administration's been working very hard to disassociate itself with.
Now, we saw a very close relationship with the Trump administration and some of what we would consider the Gulf Coast or the Gulf coalition partnerships, that particularly being the Saudis, the Emiratis. Is there
is there going to be a gap in the way that that relationship could affect Middle East policy now that we've seen the actions taken by President Biden regarding, for example, the situation in Yemen?
Yeah, that's a good question. So certainly, and I think it's important to remember that the war in Yemen started back in 2015 when the Obama administration was in office. And so the Obama administration were initially signed off on Saudi Arabia going to war in Yemen, and then very, very quickly had second thoughts. And in fact, as the Obama administration was leaving office in at the end of 2016, they actually cut off weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia thought, correctly as it turns out, that the Trump administration would reverse that. And the Trump administration pretty much allowed Saudi Arabia to continue to do what it was doing in Yemen with regards to the war. Although in 2018, the Trump administration did stop things like U.S. refueling of Saudi jets that were mid-air refueling of Saudi jets that were going on bombing runs in Yemen, largely over concerns of civilian casualties. So I think the Biden administration has come in and is having a very frank talk with the Saudi royal court and saying, basically, look, the war in Yemen is something you need to get out of, and we're here to help you get out of that war. We're not here to sort of end the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is much too important for the U.S. to just sort of throw that relationship overboard. So I think what the Biden administration is doing is something different than what the Trump administration did, but neither of them are looking to end the relationship or move from being a partner to something more antagonistic.
But Gregory, it almost seems like there was, I don't want to call it confusion or almost a kind of a fog of policy inside the Trump administration when it was talking about Yemen. Do you think that they thought their way through Yemen policy and addressing the Yemen question? For example, taking the action of identifying the Houthis as a terrorist organization, not looking at the bigger, broader picture. How big of a problem was that?
Yeah, so I would say that the Trump administration didn't really have a Yemen policy. What it had was an Iran policy, and it had a Saudi policy, and it tended to look at Yemen through the prism of those two countries. So the example that you just raised, that of designating the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, which the Trump administration did on its second to last day in office on January 19, 2021, they made that designation. That had everything to do with this maximum pressure campaign against Iran, trying to bring Iran to its knees, which is part of why the Trump administration left things like the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. They wanted to get out of that, be the Trump administration, that is, make a clear break from the Obama administration. And in doing so, when they looked at Yemen, they only saw an Iranian proxy. Now, for myself, I think that's a mistaken view. And I think if you look at Yemen only through the prism of Iran and see it only as an extension of your Iran policy, that then will lead to policy-making mistakes when it comes to that country. And I think that's what we saw throughout the Trump administration, was a series of mistakes because the administration didn't spend enough time really analyzing what was happening on the ground in Yemen and what the reality of the situation was.
Well, let me just ask you the point blank question. In your experience, in your time working in Yemen and the expertise you bring on the subject, are the Houthi rebels a terrorist organization?
So the Houthi rebels, and this is a group, so perhaps it's helpful to give a little bit of history. So the Houthis
Please do.
Yeah, so the Houthis have been fighting what was the central government in Yemen from about 2004. There was a succession of six, what are often called the Houthi Wars or the Saada Wars, which went from 2004 to 2010. Then, of course, in 2011, there was the Arab Spring, The president of Yemen is forced to step down after being in power for about 33 years. He'd been the one who was really prosecuting the wars against the Houthis from 2004 to 2010. He steps down, is forced to step down in 2011, actually vacates office in 2012. At the time, Yemen is sort of crumbling and falling apart. The Houthis take over the area of the country where they're from, which is in the far north on the border with Saudi Arabia, and eventually they're able to sort of defeat their local allies, and then in 2014, march down to the capital and basically take over the capital, put the then president under house arrest. He eventually resigns under pressure before escaping, making his way to Saudi Arabia. And then in March of 2015, Saudi Arabia starts this bombing campaign. So the Houthis have carried out a number of actions. They do things like disappearing people. They've arrested Americans. They dynamite the houses of their opponents. They are a rather despicable group in many ways, and they carry out a number of actions that are very, very worrisome. And in fact, the leader of the Houthis is under UN sanctions, as are two of his lieutenants. What's different with the FTO designation, the designation of the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, right, is A, the Houthis have not really targeted the United States. So that makes them a little bit different from a terrorist group such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS. The other major concern is that unlike, say, Al-Qaeda, the Houthis do not the Houthis control a rather sizable portion of the country in Yemen, where about 60 to 70% of the people live. So the problem with an FTO designation is that it wouldn't really harm the Houthis, because the Houthis, it wouldn't influence their behavior. It wouldn't get them to change what it is that they're doing, because the Houthi leadership is largely insulated from, you know, food shortages or medical supply issues or anything like that. So the issue that a lot of people had with the Trump administration designating the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization was that, A, the Houthi leadership wouldn't pay the price, but the people who would pay the price would be the Yemeni civilians, because you'd have private companies who are wary of running afoul of the U.S. Treasury Department and U.S. sanctions, right, who'd be then unwilling to ship in food or to deal with the government in the north, which is the Houthi-controlled government, because the Houthis are a terrorist organization, you can't have anything to do with them, or you face potential penalties in the U.S. So that's the issue, is not that the Houthis aren't a group that's carrying out these horrendous acts that are acting in a way that isn't helpful, but rather that they wouldn't be harmed by the designation. It'd be the Yemeni civilians, the being used essentially as pawns.
Right. Well, Gregory, correct me if I'm wrong on this view, but it strikes me that when we look at the Houthis designated as an FTO, you have the international NGOs that are trying to mitigate what many have said is the worst humanitarian crisis in our lifetime. Excuse me. And then we have also a noted ally, the Saudis and even the UAE, who are almost exacerbating the ongoing humanitarian crisis. Does that one rock and that one hard wall put the American foreign policy and the American diplomatic corps in an odd position?
Yeah, it's a really difficult position. And so I was at the UN at the Security Council on what's called the Yemen Panel of Experts for the final year of the Obama administration and the first year of the Trump administration. And the U.S. mission under both the Obama administration as well as the Trump administration consistently and constantly push back on the idea that the U.S. was a party to the conflict in Yemen, which is a bit of a legal term, meaning that the U.S. is one of the actors taking place in this war. But really, the U.S. was. It was providing intelligence and logistical support to Saudi Arabia. It was providing mid-air refueling to Saudi jets. Many of those jets, the U.S. didn't know what sort of bombing runs they were going on. There were some bombing runs that were planned on the ground. others that the pilots had leeway to make the decisions once they were in the air. So the U.S. really had the worst of both possible worlds in that it was involved in the war in Yemen, but it really had no say over how the war was being prosecuted. And the issue with the war in Yemen, and I think this is becoming more and more clear, is that every actor in the war, from the Saudis to the Houthis to the Emiratis, everyone has blood on their hands. So the Saudis have carried out a number of attacks that have killed civilians. The Emiratis, there are credible allegations of torture that the Emiratis carried out when they were on the ground in Yemen. They established a number of prisons which were under investigation by the United Nations. The Houthis, as we just talked about, have carried out a number of crimes, have arrested their and disappeared their political opponents. They've engaged in torture. They've used child soldiers. So everyone in this war, and you're right in saying that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis. What we don't often say about that, the end of that sentence is, and it's entirely man-made.
Yeah. Well, that brings up a good point, is we saw the almost aggressive policy approach that President Biden and Secretary Blinken are taking in regards to the Saudi involvement, by canceling the weapons sales, by stopping funding going towards any actions directly or indirectly involved in aggression or the offensive in Yemen. But what about the UAE? Is the UAE the one player that's kind of sliding under the radar? They did not say they were canceling their arms sales. And Gregory, I'm sure you've probably heard, our organization is the one that is suing the State Department and the secretary to block that sale. But one of the key factors we talk is the one of the key factors we bring up in our complaint is that the UAE is this kind of under the radar player that still gets rewarded for being an ally, although contributing to the human rights crisis in Yemen.
Yeah, that's a good question on sort of UAE policy in Yemen and sliding beneath the radar. And I think the arms sales, I may be mistaken, but I thought they'd been paused and not completely paused for review, but not necessarily canceled. But I could be wrong about that when it comes to Saudi Arabia. With regards to the UAE, I think from the very beginning, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have had different policies in Yemen. So Saudi Arabia was very concerned with the Houthis and very concerned with what they thought of as a Hezbollah-like group on their southern border. So basically, Saudi Arabia didn't want what they saw as an Iranian proxy on their southern border. The UAE, which was the other major partner of the Saudi-led coalition, has flown a bit under the radar, but the UAE's wanted something entirely different in Yemen. And you can see this by how the UAE went about prosecuting the war there in Yemen. The UAE seemed much more concerned about, say, its regional footprint in Yemen. So initially, the UAE, and this is in 2015 and 2016, put a lot more troops on the ground than did Saudi Arabia. The UAE also brought in a lot of mercenaries from Colombia, from other places, or we might call them contractors, into the war in Yemen. But very quickly, the UAE started establishing and funding, arming, and training proxy groups there in Yemen. This is groups like the Shebwani Elite Forces, the Hadhrami Elite Forces, the Security Belt Forces. And so in 2009, and all of these forces, if you can sort of envision a map of Yemen, which is right at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, all of these forces are really concentrated along the Gulf of Aden into the Indian Ocean and then up the Red Sea corridor. And at the same time, the UAE was very, very active in the Horn of Africa, in building bases, in establishing military bases and taking over ports along the Red Sea corridor for their sort of regional trade. But in the summer of 2019, the UAE started to draw down its troops in Yemen. And while it hasn't completely withdrawn, there are about four or five bases where the UAE still has troops, it's significantly drawn down most of its troops in Yemen. And now it relies almost exclusively on these proxies that it has funded and armed and trained. And to the best of, I think, my count, as well as those of others, there's about 90,000 troops that the UAE has as proxies in Yemen. And that allows the UAE to both do exactly what it is that you said, which is fly under the radar while continuing to have a major influence on how things are playing out on the ground in Yemen because of those 90,000 proxy troops it have, which don't always see eye to eye with one another on the ground, these different Yemeni proxies.
Is the situation in Yemen indicative of a larger problem in the region?
I think it is in some ways. I'd be curious in which way you mean. I think that Yemen has basically a Humpty Dumpty problem. That is, the state itself is broken and it's not going to be put back together. And so the U.S. foreign policy, the Biden administration for the next 4 years, maybe the next eight, the State Department is going to be forced to deal with countries that have fractured and fragmented and not into sort of neat pieces. Yemen before 1990, there was a North Yemen and a South Yemen. That's not going to be the case going forward. The country's fragmented into a lot of different pieces that are being held by warlords of various strength and sizes in different parts of the country. And that's something that's going to be an issue for U.S. foreign policy in places like Syria, as well as in Libya, as you're going to be dealing with these countries in which the central government is really essentially just one more armed group within the country.
Well, let me drill down to another aspect of that question. Is the Yemeni central government, or is the situation in Yemen too far gone? Is this a lost cause?
I mean, the Yemeni central government is at this point largely a fiction. The government lost its capital in 2014. That's the capital of Sana'a that the Houthis took over. Then it lost its temporary capital of Aden in 2019 when a southern secessionist group called the Southern Transitional Council forced its affiliated military units out of Yemen itself. And really the problem in Yemen is that we talk about the war in Yemen as one war, but in reality, there are three separate but overlapping wars in Yemen. So there's the U.S.-led war against groups like AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as well as ISIS. That's one war. Then there's the Saudi-led coalition war against the Houthis, which they see as an Iranian proxy. So this is the regional war. This is Saudi Arabia and the UAE against what they see as the Iranian proxy and the Houthis. But underlying all of these is this domestic Yemeni civil war, which was really simmering before 2014 and is going to last long after the Saudis withdraw, whenever it is that they do withdraw. So the U.S. might be able to end the Saudi-led coalition war in Yemen, but the U.S. is not going to be able to end this domestic civil war in Yemen. And so then you're dealing with a broken and fragmented state. And I don't think the U.S. government, as its different institutions, whether it's the National Security Council or the State Department or any of these different agencies and organizations, have really wrapped their mind around this reality that even if the Saudis leave, the war in Yemen is going to continue and is going to go on.
Well, let me ask this question. I was talking with a couple of friends of mine with other NGOs and in the different diplomatic corps here in Washington, and I made the comment that, you know, the economic interest to the region, the national security interest, not just to the U.S., but their allies, you know, we should be actively involved in stabilizing Yemen, in bringing a solution to the civil war, bringing a stabilized central government, injecting economic development into the area. And I had one friend of mine from a diplomatic corps who will remain nameless say, you're also looking for a pink unicorn. Is that true? Is the desire for a stabilized, functional, almost even possibly successful Yemen a myth?
Well, I don't think it's a myth, but it's certainly so. the U.S. can't just ignore Yemen for, I think, a variety of different reasons. So the U.S. has national security interests. There are terrorist groups that are in Yemen. We know, even going back to, say, Christmas Day of 2009, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was the group that put the underwear bomber on the flight to Detroit. That right. group still exists. It's been significantly weakened over the past decade, but it's still there, as is an ISIS affiliate. Those groups continue to have the ambition, even if they might not have the talent to target the United States. So that's going to be an interest. The humanitarian concern and potential refugees spilling out of Yemen into the broader Middle East, into Saudi Arabia, into Oman, into other places, that's going to remain a concern for the United States as well. In addition to the fact that Yemen sits in a very strategic part of the world, and Yemen is at the Bab al-Mandab, shipping lines that go up the Red Sea, that go through the Gulf of Aden into the Indian Ocean, those remain very, very important for the United States. So as much as the U.S. might wish that Yemen would just sort of go away or just fall in the sea because it's too difficult to deal with, that's not going to happen. And the U.S. is going to have to be actively involved. And it's here that I think the U.S. is facing a real challenge, because Yemen today in 2021 is much different than Yemen in 2014 or 2012. And so opportunities that the United States might have had to positively impact change in the aftermath of the Arab Spring or in 2014 and 2015, those windows have closed. And now the U.S. has to be much more humble, I think, about what it's able to accomplish. So the first step is ending this regional war. It's going to be much, much more difficult to end the local civil war. But I think from a U.S. national security perspective, as well as from a foreign policy perspective, there are things that once that regional war ends, that the U.S. might do that would have a positive impact on the situation in Yemen, but it's probably not, certainly not on its own, going to be able to end that domestic civil war.
Gregory, does the U.S. have enough, I hate to use the word street credibility, but that's the only one that comes to mind, with the Saudis and the Emiratis to get them to back away from the situation in Yemen and take a different approach?
Yeah, I think the U.S. has significant leverage over both the Saudis and the Emiratis. So Mohammed bin Salman, who's he's the crown prince, the de facto right. ruler of Saudi Arabia, he's very interested in, I think, repairing his relationship in Washington, which has suffered not only because of the war in Yemen, but also because of his murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi exiled journalist who is living right. in the U.S. working for the Washington Post. So Mohammed bin Salman is very interested in doing that. The U.S. has a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, as it does with the UAE. The U.S., as we mentioned a little bit earlier, sells both of those countries weapons. There have been a number of other – the U.K. continues to sell Saudi weapons, but a number of other European countries have announced that they are no longer selling Saudi weapons. People like Bruce Rydell, a colleague of mine at the Brookings Institution, believes that the United States, because of the Saudi Air Force, that the U.S. can basically ground the Saudi Air Force by cutting off spare parts and other things. So I think the U.S. does have both the diplomatic muscle as well as the political leverage to influence and to help Saudi Arabia and the UAE get out of this war. And I think almost as importantly as that is the fact that I think Saudi Arabia is looking for an exit. They realize this was a war that when Saudi Arabia came to the Obama administration in 2015, they said, look, this war is going to take about 6 weeks. Well, now the war has been going on for 6 years, and the Saudis are no closer to victory than when they started. In fact, they're probably farther away.
Where's the, I guess, the line? Do we go carrot with the Saudis and the Emiratis, or do we go stick with the carrot? I mean, stick with the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Well, I think you've already seen under the Biden administration a lot of conversations that are taking place between the United States and Saudi Arabia. So the Biden administration just announced Timothy Linderking. He announced that last week as the U.S. special envoy to Yemen. I believe just yesterday that Linder King was in Saudi Arabia having conversations there. He's working very closely with Martin Griffiths, who is the UN special envoy. Griffiths was just in Iran. So there's right now there's a renewed push for peace negotiations, peace settlements, right, with the Saudis. And the U.S. has significant leverage there, as we just talked about, and the U.S. can use its muscle. The problem, though, is that the Saudis aren't going to be the only one at the negotiating table. The Houthis are also going to be there. And if we're talking about leverage, then we have to say that the U.S. has much less, in fact, perhaps no leverage, at least as it's currently construed, on the Houthis to get them to not only sit down and talk, which the Houthis will do, but get them to follow through on agreements that they make, which the Houthis historically have not done.
What role does or should the United Nations play in possibly finding a sustainable solution to the Yemen question?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the UN... So, and this is coming from someone who worked at the UN Security Council, although as an outside expert on the panel of experts. So I was an employee, but not really.
Right.
The UN, and particularly the UN Security Council, I tend to think of as the international court of last resort. That is, the problems that are too difficult or too messy or that no one else wants to deal with, those are the ones that end up at the UN Security Council. And the UN Security Council, this is a body of 15 countries, 5 permanent members and 10 rotating members, you know, they have a lot of different ideas. So Russia and China have a veto in the UN Security Council,
right,
the same as the US does. The UN on its own can do very little. And I think the war in Yemen over the past 6 years has shown that. When the US was not interested in any sort of diplomatic track in Yemen under the Trump administration, the UN just cycled through several special envoys. So the UN is now on its third special envoy over the past 5 years. That's not right, because the previous two were no good at their job. It's because the previous two special envoys had really no support. And absent any support, they can't do much on their own. They're basically, the UN takes an approach of what we just talked about, basically a carrot and stick approach. So the UN Sanctions Committee, which is the committee that I served on for 2 years, basically monitors the situation for the Security Council, and it writes what are called statements of case that it provides to the Security Council, to all 15 members, saying, we believe that these individuals in Yemen, based on the designating criteria, which is, you know, what the Security Council devises to say these people are spoilers or these people are eligible for sanction, the Sanctions Committee writes them and says, we think that these individuals are eligible for sanctions. Here are the reasons. And we give that to the Security Council. And then if the Security Council decides to sanction someone, they do it on that basis.
Right.
The special envoy is basically the carrot. And he goes around and talks to different sides and basically pleads with them to sit down and make some sort of a deal at the negotiating table. But absent U.S. support, and I really think the U.S. is crucial here when it comes to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, absent any sort of U.S. support other than lip service to his mission, the special envoy wasn't able to do much. But now the special envoy has a partner in the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Timothy Linder King, who we just mentioned. And the Biden administration has made it clear that it wants out of this war. It wants Saudi Arabia to end its war. And so U.S. muscle, the hope is that it will do the trick. But on its own, the U.N. can't do much in Yemen. But with U.S. support, I think that the UN can do quite a bit.
We've only got a couple more minutes, Gregory, before the end of our segment, but a couple of things I want to ask you. Number one, looking at the broader Gulf coalition, where we talk about Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, Qatar, is that a good regional influence, or should it concern Americans involved in foreign policy?
Well, so there's 6 countries in the Gulf Cooperation Council,
right?
And you just mentioned some of them. And when Saudi Arabia went in, most of the countries in the Gulf Cooperation Council went in. This is back in 2015. Took part in the war. The only country that did not was Oman. And so what we've seen is that this is often an alliance in name only. So even Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two major partners that we talked about, they were pursuing on the ground in Yemen, they were pursuing vastly different policies. And of course, Saudi Arabia and Qatar had their dispute. Qatar left the coalition, or if you believe the Saudis, they were kicked out of the coalition. Either way, they eventually were no longer part of the coalition. Saudi Arabia and Qatar have supposedly just patched that up. But there are all these sort of rivalries and discussions and different nation states within the GCC, from Saudi Arabia to the UAE to Bahrain to Kuwait to Oman, so forth, Qatar, that are pursuing their own national interests. Most of them are involved in the war in Yemen in, to one degree or another. Even Oman, which wasn't part of the coalition because it borders Yemen, is very much involved in the conflict, particularly out in the east of Yemen. But this is not an alliance that sort of sits up and speaks with one voice, and you can believe that all of the different capitals are sort of in line. This is a very fractured and divided alliance.
Paper tiger?
Well, I mean, there certainly Saudi Arabia and the UAE, just based on their economic muscle as well as their oil fields, are able to have influence. But what they don't do is sort of unify and then speak with one voice that would amplify or magnify their influence beyond just one single country.
Yeah. Last question. I have to note, you are the author. Your last book, The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. I was intrigued by the lead title of the book. You named it The Last Refuge. Why?
Yeah, so there's a hadith, which in Islamic circles is basically a saying of the Prophet Muhammad.
This is
likely an apocryphal hadith. And the hadith runs something along the lines of, when disorder threatens, seek refuge in Yemen. And so the idea was that as Al-Qaeda was being pummeled in Afghanistan in 2001, 2002, that these fighters would come back to Yemen and use the mountainous terrain there as sort of a last refuge to rebuild, which we eventually saw with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group that Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric, and others were a part of in 2009, 2010, 11, and 12. So that's where the title of the book comes from. It's a reference to that likely apocryphal hadith.
Yeah, fascinating. That is amazing. I've got to tell you. By the way, The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia is available through most booksellers, including Amazon and Google Books. Dr. Gregory Johnson, I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for your insight, and we'll hope you come back.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more information on the subject you just heard about, or any of our articles, reports, or events, log on to nycfpa.org. Also, please consider subscribing to Message Traffic on your favorite podcast service like Apple, Google, Spotify, or TuneIn Radio. You can also follow us on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For questions regarding the center, or just to let us know what you were thinking, you can email us at info@nycfpa.org. On behalf of the board and staff of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs, thank you for listening.